I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my very special guest is Kimberly Williams. She is a poet, and we are going to talk about her first book of poems called Finally the Moon, which is a book very familiar to me because it was her thesis when she graduated in the online MFA here at UTEP, and I was her thesis director. So I'm very excited to have her on the show. As a writer and a professor, one of the most exciting things is to see a student go on and write a beautiful book, which Finally the Moon certainly is. And also as a writer, there are certain lines that I encounter that for whatever reason strike me as beautiful or strike me as just on an emotional, gut, spiritual, perhaps, level. And the other day I was reading something, and I don't even remember what it is, but I do remember encountering a line, and that line is, "Cast your bread upon the waters." And I thought it was so beautiful that I wrote it down in my notes app, which I do when I encounter something beautiful or when I have an idea or just some sort of rhythm that comes to me. It's either something I create or something I find. I did not create "Cast your bread upon the waters," but it sounded so beautiful, I wrote it in my notes app. And then I was looking at it this morning, and I didn't remember where I found it. Again, it struck me as beautiful, so I Googled it, and it comes from Ecclesiastes. So perhaps I was reading Carl Jung or something, and he had quoted this, "Cast your bread upon the waters." And at first reading, or at first encountering this, it almost sounds sad and depressing, because what the image I get is throwing loaves of bread in the ocean, and I see the loaves of bread, and they're in the waves, and eventually they get soaked up and they sink, and it's really kind of sad to waste your bread by throwing it on the water. But when I looked it up this morning, I found the next line, and it says, "For you will find it after many days. So cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days." And of course, this completely shifts the meaning from sad to hopeful. Cast your bread upon the waters. What is bread? Bread is that which feeds you, which is important. And you cast that on the waters, and it'll come back to you after many days, like a bottle comes back with a message in it. And so it continues to be beautiful. And I thought of that this morning, I think, because of Kimberly. As professors, we constantly cast our bread upon the waters. We give our students our heart and our soul, everything, our creative spirit. We put everything into it. And it does come back after many days. And that's kind of how I feel about this book, Finally the Moon. It's coming back, and it's a great pleasure as a professor to see the bread eventually coming back. So we're going to have Kimberly Williams, and we're going to talk about the bread that she cast upon the waters, her book, Finally the Moon. Stick around. Kimberly Williams has an MFA in creative writing from UTEP. She was an online MFA student, and she took me for multiple classes. She teaches at Glendare Community College in Arizona. She's a full-time professor, tenured professor, I might add. And this is her first book of poems, Finally the Moon. Kimberly, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
Now, you have a really interesting poet's trajectory or career or narrative. You were already in a really good job. I mean, you have the kind of job that, you know, most people would love to have. You're a college professor. You teach at a community college. You teach English, which I assume is a little literature, a little composition.
Yeah, and a lot of creative writing.
And yet you still decided that you were going to pursue an MFA in creative writing. Mm-hmm. Why did you do that, a full-time job and get an MFA at the same time?
I did that because I knew that as a poet, my next step was that I had to put a book together.
Uh-huh.
And I was not doing it. And I knew that if I took the MFA program, that's how it would end up. And that's what I would end up doing. And so I would reach that goal. And then I knew along the way, too, just taking classes, it had been many years. It would bring me up to speed on contemporary writers and also develop me more professionally. And that's how I've been able to teach a lot more creative writing classes now. So it was a really good call because I got more experience. I got my book and I got my MFA.
And one of the, I think, really important things for career people is to not just to be comfortable in what you're doing and do it over and over and over until you can't do it anymore, but to challenge yourself. And it sounds like the experience might have been a great challenge.
It really was a great challenge. And I took a flash fiction prose poetry class from Lex.
Lex Williford.
And I'm teaching it now.
Nice.
You know, a version of it here. So next semester will be the second time I teach it.
Wow. And before you got an MFA, you had a master's degree?
I have a master's in literature.
In literature.
In English Lit.
From where?
From Case Western Reserve in Ohio.
Okay. And so you were in our MFA program. I've had you, you were in multiple classes, and I know you very well because even one summer you came to the London study abroad trip. I think when you went, it was London and Madrid that we did a week in each town. One of the experiences I had going through an MFA program, and now I teach in an MFA program, is I find myself not only teaching similar courses that my professors taught, but sometimes I would open my mouth and out would come my professor's words. Does that happen to you?
It does. Like the whole thing with semicolons, you know?
Uh-huh.
I think it's really hard not to.
Yeah.
Or even sometimes, I remember when Lex used to read our papers, he would do, if he wanted us to show, we were doing too much telling, he literally would type, "how to show?" question mark. And I do that now to my students.
Nice, nice. That's great. Yeah, I did the same thing. You know, there's this one professor I had, and it's not that we emulate one professor, but it's really kind of just a mixture and an amalgamation of everything we've learned, not only in the classroom, but reading texts and our own teaching and stuff. So I imagine you are an amazing professor, and your students are lucky to have you.
Oh, thank you.
So one of the goals for the MFA program here at UTEP, we say it right from the beginning, is that we want the candidates to finish a book after 3 years and to publish that book. And you did it. This was your thesis, and you published it. How does that make you feel?
There are some days I remind myself that I did it. But it makes me feel just very grateful, actually. That I was able to do it, that I had the opportunity to get it published, that I had the opportunity to even write the book and work with you. And I just feel really grateful for that and a little bit proud.
Yeah, well, it's not unusual for our students to publish their theses because we have brilliant students, as you know, but it is unusual for them to publish them so quickly after they graduated. Yours, it seemed like you turned it in, you got all your signatures from your committee members, and then before you know it, we were writing blurbs. So how did the process go from thesis to finding a publisher?
So I sent out, and I actually even was a finalist for a competition, a first book competition. Uh-huh. And he wrote me himself and said, you know, if you don't find a home for this the next year, write me back and remind me we have this conversation. But then I contacted Kim Verhines, who's at Stephen F. Austin State University Press, and she took it. And so it was kind of one of those where it was less formal, and it was like I sent it off to her on the recommendation of a colleague, and then bam, it happened.
And how long from the time she received or that you sent the manuscript to the time that you got the go ahead?
I sent it to her, I think, in May, and I got the go ahead the next month.
Wow, that's you know, that's unusual.
Yeah.
Some people could spend years trying to get a book of poems published. You said you entered it to some contest. How many contests did you enter it into, and how much did it cost you, and at what point did you say maybe the contest route isn't the way to go?
Well, I think I entered it in about 3, and it wasn't terribly expensive. It was like maybe $25 a time, but I think that I was willing to keep an open mind. It didn't have to be a contest, or it didn't, and so when my colleague said, you know, you should send this specifically here, and, you know, it had a name, and so I wasn't just sending it into the void, but I actually sent it to her, you know, as an attachment on an email and was able to introduce myself and be more personal. It worked that way.
Yeah, and I bet I can guess who that colleague was that made the suggestion, and He's another very successful poet that graduated from our online MFA.
Yes. Not only that, but he and I started the same semester.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The same semester. Wow. We did. It was completely uncanny because we both had to tack on an extra one semester.
Oh, you know, I hated it when you guys took my classes. I have to be honest right now. I hated having you in my class.
Why?
Because you made me work harder. No, I don't really mean that. You and I'm going to say his name, James Cherry, a fantastic poet. When you guys were in my classes, it just enhanced the classes so much. You guys were fantastic writers, and I loved how you thought about writing and how you seemingly always thought about writing. And the book, Finally the Moon, is your MFA thesis. And is there much different between the very final draft of your thesis and the final copy of this book?
You know, it's not terribly different, except for that I think I added, I don't even know how many, maybe half a dozen poems.
Uh-huh.
That really I felt did give it closure. I think one of the things I learned most from working with you on the thesis one and thesis two was the idea of an arc. And I couldn't see that before, and I was actually having trouble seeing the big picture, and I'm kind of a big picture person, so I was very frustrated. And then I think I trusted myself a little bit more, and then our conversations, and then suddenly I saw it, like poof, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so I was able to add a few poems at the end that I think helped sort of complete the overarching part of the book.
And you decided to call it Finally the Moon.
Yeah.
And that is one of the poems in here. But I know that the title, Finally the Moon, it not only represents one of the poems in the book, but in many ways it represents the book itself. Can you tell us why that title and how it might hold the book together in a certain sense?
Sure. Well, it's funny. It was James who in the end helped me decide on it. He and I we became friends because of the program, and we just stayed in contact. So he helped me pick it. But the more I would say it, the more I would see it, the more I realized it really worked, because I think it's the idea of arrival. And it felt like a long time to arrive to this manuscript, to arrive to this book.
Oh, I love that, because it's not only comments on that particular poem and not only on some thematic connections and even the arc, because the sections are titled in terms of moon imagery. You have the new and the waning, the full and the waning again. But I like that idea of it being also a metaphor, or at least that metaphorical possibility of the writer itself finally getting their book, because to get a book is like reaching for the moon. And here it is. This is why I'm offering you the book. Finally, here it is, the moon. That's wonderful.
Yeah. I wrote my first book of poetry in third grade, but I still have it. And so I always thought about writing. I always thought about words and language even when I was very, very young. And so I think it felt like it did take a while to finally arrive. And yet when it did, it was there just like a full moon. It was just in the sky.
That's nice.
Yeah,
you got to reach for the moon sometimes.
That's right.
I remember the title of the very first story I wrote, because, you know, I'm a fiction writer, mostly short stories. It was called Hamburger versus Hot Dog. And it was about a giant hamburger and a giant hot dog that had a fight in the middle of the streets of New York City. Everyone was going, help, help. And then it was broken up by Super Taco, which probably has a commentary on my culture. But anyway...
Right?
You got a book, Finally the Moon, poems by Kimberly K. Williams. It's brand new. It's a beautiful book of poems. One of the things that a writer today learns immediately is that the work, although it isn't writing the book. The work comes after the book is published. How have you been handling being a writer that needs to set up readings, that needs to get that book out there? Are you good at it?
No, it's a learning curve for sure. I've definitely done some. I probably need to reach out a little bit more out of state. But I have James who regularly emails and says, where are you submitting? Where are you reading? He is always keeping me accountable.
That's great.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that a writer needs to do is be proactive. A writer needs to create opportunities for herself as opposed to waiting for the opportunities to come. There used to be this image of the writer. We'd write a book and then we sit by the phone and wait for the press to call and all the invitations to come. But that just doesn't happen anymore.
No.
Are you able to get on the phone and be proactive and set up your own readings and do your own promotion?
I have been able to do some of that. Phoenix has a really, I think, a very solid and also very friendly community of writers. I've been able to do like this. I'm participating in a group reading, but I'm able to bring my book, read from it, sell it. So yes, I think in part being in a community that's just very excited when anybody has an accomplishment and really ready to celebrate is just really helpful. And then, like, I'm signing at AWP in March.
At what what table?
At the Stephen F. Austin
nice.
Table.
Nice. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I wish I could be there. That's the one AWP I'm not going to.
No.
But there'll be a lot of UTEP presence there, including the online MFA. We'll have a table there. So go by and say hi to Xochitl and Jonathan and all the faculty. They'll be doing signings, Sasha Pimentel, Jose de Pierola, and Rosa Alcala will all be doing signings at that table.
Great.
Do you enjoy having a book?
I do. I really am not kidding, though. I think sometimes I have to remind myself because it's, I'm already thinking, okay, well, what am I doing next?
Right.
And I almost have to slow down and just be with what I have right now.
Right, right. So let's talk a little bit about the writing of the book itself. There are many poems in this book. What is the earliest poem that you recall writing? And at the time that you wrote it, who were you at that time? And did you even think it was ever going to go into a book?
Oh, wow. What a great question. I think one of the earliest poems that I wrote in the book is a poem. It's a short poem. I actually put it towards the back. And it's, it's a short poem, and the speaker is on a baseball diamond kind of changing into herself, like, metaphorically. And I think that was one of the first poems I wrote. I had no idea that it would be in a book. I wrote it in a class with Sasha. And at the time, I think I was in the middle of a transformation with myself. And that's really, in fact, what the poem is about. So I'm not quite sure who I was at that time, but I recognized that at some point I was changing or transforming. I think growing up more comfortable with myself. I think that took quite a while to happen for me.
Right.
And it was really kind of reflective of that transformation and how it could be metaphorically a moment, even though I'm sure it happened slowly over time.
And lately, thinking a lot about this idea that writers, in many ways, not always, but in many ways, in many cases, writers are writing books about returning home. And I'm wondering what it means for you to return home.
I think it's, for me, finally, I realized this, it's returning to language. Because like I said, I was that kid who would sit and think, listening to the adults talk. Why does one person pronounce a certain word one way? And, I don't know if most kids think that way, and I didn't verbalize it. But I was always thinking about language. And because I don't live in Detroit where I grew up anymore, and I haven't for quite a while, I've lived in different places in the Southwest, Detroit still feels like home, but I don't return very often. So I think for me, it's language. And wherever where I can be with language, it's opening a book of poetry at night before I go to sleep. For me, that's going home. Reading Philip Levine's poem.
Well, that's
really going home,
Oh, that's a lovely way of looking at it. And then it's, of course, highly significant that you mentioned Philip Levine, because he too was from Detroit and he too hadn't lived there in years, but really spent most of his life writing about it because that was home for him.
Yes. When I read his poetry, which I just sort of return to almost cyclically, it's like coming home.
Yeah. I had the honor of having him on the show, about a year before he died. Of course, I knew him. I actually lived in his house for a while, and that was a lot of fun. But I like that. Yeah, the idea of returning home is returning to language, and it really kind of makes a lot of sense on so many different, you know, metaphorical levels. But that was the first poem that you wrote for this book, and you wrote it when you started the MFA program, your first year.
Yes, I did. That's exactly right. It was my first year.
So all these poems are from your MFA experience?
They really pretty much are. There is one poem in there where like a stanza comes from something I wrote years ago in Colorado.
Uh-huh.
I really reworked it, transformed it, you know, and it's just this one little part of it.
Right.
And then there are some references, like losing my glasses, you know, things that happened earlier and somehow came back around through memory and the way that memory works with writing.
Finally, The Moon, poems by Kimberly K. Williams. Kimberly, what was the hardest poem for you to write in terms of, you know, recrafting? Because I know there's sometimes we go back to, I could write a story in a week and then other stories might take me years because I'm having so many problems with it. But then also, a lot of these poems are very close to home emotionally, returning mm-hmm. home emotionally. And so I imagine maybe some of them were hard to write on that level, too. What was the hardest poem to write?
I think there were a couple. One of the hardest poems is Towards the Back, It's the Center of Love, because it's about sort of that process. My father died, and he had maybe at the time I wrote the poem, he'd only been gone a handful of months. And my father, he worked at Wayne State University, and he was in academia for years. And the semester started, and I didn't realize how much our relationship revolved around the academic year. You know?
Right.
And so the semester started, and there was this huge void. Like, I wasn't calling him to tell him about my classes or my students. And so that poem was very hard to write because I think, you know, grief can really have its way with a writer, and the language can come out, and it can be overly sentimental, or it can be hard to form, or, you know. So that one emotionally was very, very challenging. And then the other poem was the one on the metro. And it was one that I wrote when we were in Spain, and you really challenged me with this poem. I showed you an early draft, and you said no.
Uh-huh.
It was about encountering a homeless man.
Oh yeah, I remember
on the metro, and you were like, "No, this is just this is just a poem about middle class guilt," you know. And you were so right, and so I really had to ask myself, what am I really going for in this poem in terms of what's the heart of it? And it was, you know, there's that whole thread in the book about angels, and it was that I wanted to look at the dark side, you know. I mean, metaphorically, there's a whole shadow to this idea. And I was afraid, you know. I wasn't letting myself really scrutinize kind of this moment and what was really there until you challenged me. And so I had to, the poem completely transformed in every way. I think if we looked at the original draft, we might not even, it would just be the seed.
Well, you know, sometimes all things work for the good, because I remember specifically reading that poem and I was just hungover and didn't want to deal with it. So I said, hey, this... No, just kidding. We give our online students the opportunity to meet once a year. We go to Europe. We went to London, Madrid, Paris, and you were there the year we went to Madrid, and we saw you went to Madrid and London. I remember in London, I teach Swedenborg in one of the Gateway classes, and our apartments in London happened to be right down the street from the Swedenborg house. So we all gathered there and took a picture and talked about Swedenborg, who, very interesting guy who thought he talked with angels and thought the angels showed him heaven and hell. They took him around as if they were tour guides. But I'm wondering, in general, how that trip might have fed you creatively and contributed to this book and maybe even beyond.
It was absolutely a moment that I needed to happen. And I think I went on the trip knowing that I needed it. I can't say that I really had writer's block. But I had a couple months where nothing came. You know, all I could do was journal, and there was nothing in it that I could use for my poetry. And I was beginning to worry.
Yeah.
And then I landed in London and we all met up. We weren't there 24 hours and I had a Holmcomb almost whole, you know, where there's that grace where it's sort of delivered. And it broke me out of that rut.
Right.
And then, you know, really, there are so many poems in the book that come from the trip. And then the whole connection, the whole Swedenborg connection for me means so much, because I think it was finally the invitation that I had been waiting for to connect my writing to something larger, not necessarily religious, but, you know, you don't often get that invitation, especially in graduate school. But I felt it, you know, there it was. You know, when we looked at Duende, when we looked at the Edward Hirsch book, Angels and Demons, you know, just this idea that creativity, I think, comes from somewhere beyond ourselves and manifests itself in us through who we are. And that came to me on our trip, right? All of that sort of swelled up at once.
It just
gave me permission to keep going forward.
And it was a good group that year. We had you, John Velt, Lupe Mendez, and Eric Luthy.
Yes.
I believe it was a really good group. Kimberly, we're running out of time, but before we go, can you read a short poem for us from your book,
sure.
Finally the Moon?
Sure. So I'm going to read On the Corner of Bedford Place and Bloomsbury. And this is that poem that I was just talking about that finally came.
That was the neighborhood we were staying in. It was Bloomsbury, wasn't it? And it was right near where Virginia Woolf used to write, and also near the Swedenborg House. And it was really quite a fantastic neighborhood.
It really was. And when I did my master's degree, And I actually worked on some PhD coursework, and one of my areas was Victorian Lit, so British Victorian Lit. So for me, I took a whole Virginia Woolf class.
Oh, nice. Okay, let's hear the poem.
Okay. On the corner of Bedford Place and Bloomsbury, not the leaves shaping hands for the maple, not nighttime dreams that suggest which side walk to take, not even the green air or the dog with his yellow teeth, and not the cries of an infant, his open mouth like a baby O. Not even silence, which you could at least slip over your fingers like a glove. What comes in this waiting? No words, no letters to lend shape, no long line to run down the page like a path carved among trees. Not the red letter post box or the shrill sound of traffic, buses looming two stories high, running left along the road. Syllables and clouds are frozen in the sky. Nothing arrives but this space, white, sullen, wide, and piled high with waiting.
That was Kimberly K. Williams reading from her new book of poems, Finally the Moon. Kimberly, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. Wish you the best of luck with this book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
I'd like to thank Kimberly Williams for joining us on Words on a Wire. The book is called Finally the Moon. Please pick it up. It's her very first book, but I predict it will not be her last. I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining me on Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank our producer, Lauren Terrazas, and we'll see you next week.